Can I have your attention, please? Thank you. Hi, I'm Robert Rosenkranz, and as a trustee of the Manhattan Institute, it's my privilege to introduce Professor Richard Epstein. It's a cliche for introducers to describe their task as a privilege, but for me it truly is, and in part for somewhat personal reasons that I'm going to get to. Richard Epstein is among the most outstanding legal scholars that we have. He stands tall among the pantheon of brilliant scholars who pioneered the field of law and economics, men such as Aaron Director, Ronald Coase, Frank Easterbrook, Richard Posner. As the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago, his work has looked deeply at virtually every area of the law. His writing is a masterpiece of nuanced persuasion. His thinking is not that of the ideologue, but of the pure intellectual who follows his thoughts to their logical and often surprising conclusions. In his provocative new book, How Progressives Rewrote the Constitution, he addresses many key themes in constitutional law and history. The old court emphasis on individual liberty and private property and the structures of federalism to restrain central government. And then the emphasis during the progressive era on government intervention to address perceived social ills and changing conditions. He underscores the importance of the scope of judicial review where constitutional protections are an issue, whether courts should have a strong presumption that the legislature has acted rationally or adopt instead a standard of strict scrutiny requiring narrowly tailored means to affect compelling state interests. He draws a rigorous line between legal principles that promote economic liberty and competition and those that in effect create state-run or regulated cartels. Now, in keeping with the SEC rules on full disclosure, I'd like to touch on some of my personal ties with Richard Epstein. Nonetheless, we're bound by them. His book, Simple Rules for a Complex World, was critical to my own children's success as law students. That book, which they read before attending law school, made them fully engaged students because they had the intellectual framework for thinking critically about the views and ideology they were hearing in the classroom. My son is now a law professor at Georgetown, and my daughter is counsel to the Constitution on the Senate Judiciary Committee. My daughter graduated from NYU Law, and my son attended there for a year before transferring to Yale. And through them, I developed a real friendship with NYU's dean, Ricky Revesz. He came to agree with my contention that there was simply not enough intellectual diversity on the faculty and suggested doing something about it, recruiting Richard Epstein from Chicago. This seemed to me a long shot, but one I cheerfully agreed to fund. So it's been a very long courtship, but I'm very proud to say that Richard will be joining the NYU law faculty, teaching there one semester a year, starting next fall, I believe. But what impact can one half-time professor have in an overwhelmingly liberal faculty with scarcely a single Federalist Society member and with more Naderites than Republicans? Well, in Richard Epstein's case, quite a lot. He's taught courses in civil procedure, communications, constitutional law, contracts, corporations, criminal law, and I'm just up to the C's, health law and policy, individual estate and corporate taxation, jurisprudence, labor law, land use planning, legal history, patents, property, real estate development finance, Roman law, torts, and workers' compensation. So Richard stands ready to debate anyone on any topic at any time. And he will almost always carry the day. He extemporizes in full paragraphs, which can be taken down and published verbatim. There is no editing required. He talks twice as fast as anybody else, and he thinks twice as straight. He's an intellectual force of nature, and you're in for a treat when you hear him today.
I think my first reaction is duh. I'm not quite sure. You know, normally when people start to build you up, you figure, oh, they leave a little room for you to exceed expectations. But I'm afraid, Robert, under these circumstances, everything I'm going to do is going to be a grave disappointment relative to the fine introduction that you gave of some fellow who happens to bear my name and perhaps my personal identity. But be that as it may, I am here to talk about problems which I think tie into some of the themes that were stated early on. I have very strong intellectual predispositions. I have never regarded myself as an ideologue, although Lord knows I've been called that on more occasions than once. I do believe that ideas matter, and very much in the University of Chicago tradition, I'm happy to say. I think once you figure out what the major premises are and you start to drive them as far and as hard as they will go, you will come up with a way in which you will re-understand your own presuppositions and eventually come to modify or to change them. And certainly in my own life, that has definitely been the case, because one of the themes that I talk about in this book is, in effect, why it is I came to abandon a very hardline libertarian philosophy and have introduced the whole notion of classical liberalism as a more dominant theme, mainly because the former makes it very difficult to figure out how you structure taxation, eminent domain, and government generally, whereas the latter allows you to do this but runs the slippery slope of saying that the state, which is strong enough to provide for various forms of infrastructure, is strong enough to provide for all sorts of crazy forms of income redistribution, wealth transfer, and the like. And so essentially the major task that one has to face as a scholar is to understand why it is that you need to create government in the first place, and then to develop a series of rules and techniques which will allow you to have that government without having it go far beyond its appointed purposes and achieve results which are deleterious to the very people whom it's trying to govern. And in one sense, of course, the United States has been an absolute triumph of success in this situation. If you're thinking about liberty and you're thinking about property, you could kind of rate it in two ways. On the one hand is, what sort of fear do you have with respect to bodily integrity, as opposed to the fears that you have with your inability to transact businesses in certain ways? What fear do you have that your land will be confiscated, as opposed to the fact that it will be, quote unquote, merely zoned? And to the extent that there are very few nations that are able to secure the first set of property and liberty rights against government depredation, one of the things that we could say about this nation is that we've been able to achieve that much, at least through constitutional means, and it's something for which we all ought to be exceedingly grateful. And so when I make the rest of my remarks, which is going to be critical of much of what goes on in constitutional discourse in the United States, I think it ought to be understood against the background that the first and most essential task of government we have succeeded in, and for something for which we ought to be exceedingly grateful. But the second task, how it is that we deal with the ability of individuals to deal with their labor, how we deal with people to develop and to mature their property, we've not been as successful at in what's going on. And the question you have to ask quite simply is, where is the shortfall taking place? And generally speaking, there are always two kinds of ways you could have shortfalls. On the one hand, you could have slips in execution from a plan which is well ordained, and that certainly happens with respect to our Constitution or anything else. But generally speaking, when you get major miscarriages and misdirections, it's not just simply a question of a false step here or there. What it is you set yourself out in the wrong direction and have started from the wrong kinds of premises. And what this little book is about is the two sorts of premises that you could bring to bear on dealing with government as it relates to these issues of property disposition and economic liberties, and to see where they two paths lead and the consequences that they generate. And the point here is not to stress difficult cases at the margin. Any clever law professor can always plague a student by making the following proposition. Here are two cases on opposite sides of the line that are so close together you could barely distinguish them. Here are two cases on the same side of the line that are so far apart that you can't understand why you treat them the same. The problem is, no matter where you draw a line, that phenomenon will always exist. And so what you do is you have a situation in which strong categories necessarily invite marginal cases. As an adjudicator, as a litigator, you worry about those, but we're not worried about the margins now. We're trying to figure out where the basic categories ought to be aligned. And on this point, we can identify, I think, a very powerful transformation in judicial philosophy and in political philosophy that has taken place over the 200 years. And the progressives, I think, are more responsible than any other group for the transformation, and the transformation in the wrong direction on this particular question. If you go back and you start to read those philosophers and political theorists and lawyers who wrote about constitutional order in the period about the founding and somewhat before, I think they all started with a reasonably coherent political philosophy, which then allowed them to develop both institutional structures, federalism is the one that Bob referred to, and individual rights, economic liberties, in a rather coherent fashion. And these are the people who have always influenced me the most. I think every one of them makes mistakes, but I learn more from their errors than I do from the truths of many people who are lesser than them. So you start thinking about Locke and Montesquieu and Hume and Smith and Madison and so forth. And what was their view? Well, they all start with a view of man, and that means all of you. And I have to say, it is not entirely flattering, but at least it does have a little bit of realism about it, which tempers the level of naive perfectionism, which is, to my mind, the bane of all political theory. And what it is not that we're all conceived in original sin, but that we're all conceived with a healthy dose of self-interest, and that what one has to do is to find ways in which you could direct that self-interest into channels that will make it socially productive and to prevent it from working in particular ways that become socially destructive. You then have to figure out exactly which are those things which meet the constructive and destructive ways. And I'm just going to give you the first cut, not the final cut. But essentially, 90% of the truth lies in this simple proposition. Acts of aggression tend to be socially destructive. Acts of cooperation tend to be socially constructive. And so that what you want to do is to find a way in which consensual transactions take the dominance over trespass and theft. And the question is, what sort of institutional and property arrangements do you want to do this? Well, clearly you're going to have some degree of government, because otherwise you have a situation, to use the famous Lockean phrase, in which every person in a state of nature enjoys executive power over the world and is incapable of enforcing the law for his own behalf. There is a problem, of course, that no one ought to be a judge in his own cause, and so therefore private enforcement of natural rights to liberty and property is necessarily a broken enterprise, and what each of us therefore agree to do in some grand transaction is to enter into a situation where we give up some of our liberty and some of our property in exchange for which we receive state protection for that which remains to us. And the hope is that what we surrender will cost us, but that what we receive will give us more benefit than the price that we've otherwise paid. But since we are starting from the presumption of human fallibility rather than from the assumption of human perfection, what we try to do is to devise our institutions in ways that those who are given the monopoly power over us are in fact going to be constrained in one way against each other. And we have developed only three ways in which to deal with this problem, two of which I talk about in this little book. The first of them has to deal with separation of powers, and for those of you who know business, if you've got a valuable trade secret, you don't give all the keys to the safe to one person. You divide them here, there, and the other place. The exact pattern of the division really matters in particular cases, but the fact that you have some form of division is, in fact, a recognition of the proposition. Better that we go a little bit slow, because if we start to go too fast, the wrong people will seize the reins of power and direct us in a bad direction. And the second kind of intuition that we have as a first approximation is that since sovereigns, even if you divide powers, are likely to be corrupt or divided in certain ways in certain cases, what you want to do is to play them off one against another. The financial types call this diversification across sovereigns. What you do is you take your money and you put it in lots of different places. You want to be able to move it back and forth on the grounds that if there's competition between sovereigns, that's going to slow up the situation in terms of any abusive deeds. And federalism is the American answer on that particular problem. If, in fact, you then start to look at the activities within individual states, what you discover is that all answers are partial, and federalism is not perfect. You may be able to move labor, and you may be able to move developers back and forth across state boundaries, but you can't move land. And so to the extent that you have a situation where there's a state monopoly over a local fixed asset, you have to have some direct forms of preservation, and those get you into the realm of private property on the one hand and individual liberty on the other. And so even though a lot of the founders did not put it in exactly these kinds of terms, this tripod strategy is remarkably consistent in the way in which the original doctrine started to be developed. But of course it turns out that there are complications, as with all of this stuff, because in some cases if you start to play one sovereign off against another, what you will do is you will create all sorts of animosities and conflicts so that people will use their sovereign power in one state to block entry by traders who come in from another. One of the things that's really quite remarkable about our Constitution is in dealing with the federalism, we tended to have a pretty good sense of where it is that local governments will do good by way of competition and where it is local governments would do bad by way of the way in which they strangle trades. And we have a whole variety of clauses in the Constitution that are designed to deal with that, including the Commerce Clause. And on the question of individual liberties, we have a whole variety of provisions dealing with private property, the Due Process, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, the Contracts Clause. Now, in speaking about all of these clauses, I'm only talking about a part of the Constitution, and I was pressed very hard before this conversation began as to whether or not I'm going to fall into the trap of believing that our Constitution has been perfect in all its dimensions. And the answer is I may from time to time lapse in that direction, but I'm acutely aware of the fact that we had a three-fifths rule, a Fugitive Slave Act, and an electoral college that was supposed to engage in deliberation for the president. Now, knowing all of these things, I can't defend them all. I'm not going to try. And so when I talk about the progressive revolution, I'm going to confine my attention to those particular doctrines of American constitutional law as they grew up from the original materials which they attacked. The doctrines which they attacked, however, which were in fact doctrines that we ought to have had. In order to explain how this goes, it's probably useful at the outset to spend at least a little time explaining how, in the grand sweep of things, the earlier doctrines on federalism on the one hand and individual rights on the other hand mapped rather nicely into the political theory of the founders, Madison, Locke, and so forth, in dealing with the kinds of questions that any government has to do. Let's start briefly with the Commerce Clause. This is a most imperfect provision. It says Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations among the several states and with the Indian tribes. And it's quite clear to some extent the purpose here was to allow this nation to forge a set of protective tariffs which would prevent the free flow of goods back and forth across international trade. And to the extent that it has that particular function, I do not think that there's any sensible interpretation of the Constitution that would deny it, but one can, as a political matter, be very unhappy about it. But on the domestic front, it turns out that the situation was a little bit more complicated. The ability to regulate commerce amongst the several states has to be read in light of the foreign commerce power. And what that suggests is that it's cross-border transactions of one form or another that are primarily at stake, in which the marginal cases will try to figure out when goods go between three and four places before they reach their final consumption destination, when are they in and when are they out of interstate commerce. And until about 1935, the courts did a tolerably good job in figuring out that way. And the reason why you like federal power as an enumerated ground on these things is that what it does is it gives you yet another protection against the ability of states to blockade the transportation of goods going back and forth across lines. And lest anyone think that this was not a serious issue, Chancellor Kent, who is no lightweight, in the years before Gibbons and Ogden in 1824, had taken the position that the federal power only allowed the federal government the ability to establish inspection stations at the borderline as goods would go back and forth. And Gibbons and Ogden has a huge discussion of how it is that commerce extends to navigation into the interior of the state, not because it's difficult as a matter of first principle, but because the dominant position on the part of many state judges was exactly the opposite on this particular point. And so when you have this particular power, the question you're going to have to ask is it going to be exercised as a way to allow the federal government to rig markets across states, as it does in foreign commerce, or is it going to be allowed to be used in ways to make sure that states don't block competition by putting up local barriers? And it's here that the good fortune in Gibbons and Ogden was such that the first case that came up was not a situation where a federal monopoly tried to dominate state competition, but rather the converse. It was a situation in which the state of New York had granted to Robert Fulton a monopoly to use machine, steam engines inside New York waters. You want to talk about franchises and monopolies and intellectual property going haywire, you don't have to look at modern times. You could go right back to 1820 and you could start to see these grants. And then you have somebody else who wants to run a ferry with a steam engine from Elizabethtown, New Jersey into the New York Harbor. And so the two powers are in clash. And what our friend Marshall said is, first of all, the journey is covered under the Commerce Clause. Then he waffled a little bit and said that the Licensing Act meant that the statute, in fact, protected what was going on. Federal preemption, therefore, defeated the state monopoly. It was a crashing defeat for state rights at the time on an issue which was regarded as rather important. The latent portion of this was, if this licensing statute isn't there, could we say that the commerce power of its own force would allow the interstate competition in the face of a state monopoly. And in decisions that took place in the next 10 to 20 years, the Supreme Court started to develop, in remarkable sophistication, the Dormant Commerce Clause, which essentially allowed a classical liberal model of government to go back and forth across the state lines. State power was essentially not allowed to block interstate transactions in the absence of congressional authorization that they could do so. And the only exceptions that you had to those were exceptions that are perfectly consistent with the classical liberal concerns with respect to trade. The most important one of these is that the good stuff that you're shipping into my state is in fact a fish which is perfectly harmless in your state, but deadly poisonous to everything else in my state. I can keep that stuff out in order to protect health. And if you look at the free trade agreements under the WTO, they have exactly the same very narrow health kind of provision in there, because you do not want to allow trade that generates negative externalities. This is one of these fine points and curlicues that you have to deal with in a comprehensive system, but you ought never to allow the safety exceptions to free trade to completely swallow the doctrine. What has been the Supreme Court attitude on this one? On the negative side, in the Dormant Commerce Clause, I'm happy to say that this current bunch of progressive judges has, for the most part, been perfectly consistent with the competitive ideal. And so that even if you look to most modern cases, essentially the deviation from the common markets that you can induce by state behavior are relatively minor to this particular point in time. And I think we all owe the court an enormous debt of gratitude that for a doctrine which has rather shaky judicial origins, they haven't messed it up by allowing state protectionism to ruin the gains of union. But it's at this point that we start to see, on the Commerce Clause at least, a really odd kind of inversion. When you get to the affirmative commerce power, there is no doubt that the classical liberal judges, for the most part, believed in the principle, textually, of enumerated powers and were able to enforce the line between commerce as the goods moving back and forth or individuals moving back and forth in cross-border transactions as against the situation in which the national government had the power to regulate manufacture, mining, agriculture, and other legal situations. And if you think about this, this is exactly the kind of situation that you would want when viewed from the most modern view of economic theory. If you have local regulation of the so-called standard productive injuries, the industries, the states will be in competition with one another, and this will place a consistent lowering effect on the degree of state regulation. We know this because in 1918, when Hammer and Degenhardt came before the Supreme Court, John W. Davis insisted that there had to be a federal child labor law in the great progressive tradition, because otherwise the states would have this race to the bottom. He never explained why it was a race to the bottom as opposed to a race to the top. And as was so typical about the progressives, they were passionate in their belief that you had to understand the deep empirical necessities of the time. And yet Brandeis and all the other great supporters of child labor laws never realized that these things were rapidly withering away, meaning, in effect, child labor became much less common by 1920 than it was in 1890. The way in which you stop child labor is to raise real incomes, and everything else will take care of itself. And that would be what the classical liberal position was. The great believers in laissez-faire always thought that patience was the way in which you solved all problems, but that hasty intervention would only create further dislocations. And this is a classical instance of how it was. So if you start looking, therefore, at these guys, what they did is they said the federal government could regulate the networks, which means, in effect, that you can control monopoly power by various entities on the rails and so forth, but that they couldn't regulate local production because state regulation was much less dangerous than federal one. This is not some ancient conception that ought to be easily tossed aside. As best I can tell, it's the first best solution by anybody who looks at this thing as a kind of structural matter, saying I've got complete textual freedom, this is the way in which I want to go. When you start getting to the New Deal, you can summarize it and the progressive legacy all in one proposition. The choice between monopoly and competition as a mode of production is strictly left to the political branches of government, period. That's what they believed, and in fact, one of the things that's quite striking about all the great constitutional transformations that took place in the New Deal ages is, without exception, they were always being put forward as a way to prop up a state-run cartel that could not be enforced at the state level. I can't give you all the illustrations of that, but let me just mention to you a couple here. First, National Labor Relations Act. It turns out that if you really start to have strong state laws on unionization, the migration of labor back and forth across state lines is such that it would be largely defeated. make it a National Labor Relations Act. Now you got to go offshore. Those options are much more restricted. And so there is no question that the reason why it was that the progressive wanted federal rather than state laws on this area is because they knew that the exit option was too potent and would otherwise defeat them. If they were right that unions were a superior form of institutional organization, then they would have been doing a wise thing. But one of the great mistakes that the progressives always made is that they somehow assume that bilateral monopolies outperform competitive markets. They really believe that high transactions costs were the sign of productivity instead of a high velocity of transactions with low transactions costs. They love to have people dicker over the back fence and spend all their time in wasteful transacting rather than having them buy something at very low cost at a supermarket. So they were in favor of chain store restrictions and anything else which would allow the old and inefficient modes of production to last against the new, more impersonal styles. And I think most of you realize that if you look around, the fact that you shop here at Duane Reade means, of course, that you don't love your families. And the reason is that anybody who engages in one of these quick transactions with these large supermarkets and businesses necessarily thinks that cash is the only thing that matters. And so, therefore, when your kid gets a cold, you tell him, I don't care about it. You go to Duane Reade. I'm not going to do it for you. It just doesn't work out that way. One of the things that we do understand is in a system of voluntarism, world works best if, in fact, you have relatively strong arm's-length transactions with strangers and relatively different kinds of forms of associations within families. People have figured it out by themselves. You don't have to legislate on that. All you have to do is to let them get married, get a mortgage, and raise a family, and essentially the system of culturalization will more or less take care of itself. So you have this. And then the second illustration has to do with agricultural stuff. And here, if you go back to the empirical studies from the 1930s, one of the sobering features that you realize is every time you managed to rig a cartel in milk or dairy products or something of the sort, what you did is you reduced the caloric intake of underprivileged children. And that was what the federal government specialized in. The great case of Wickard and Philbin, which came down in 1942, which is the hallmark of modern constitutionalism on these various federalism, says that you are solemnly said to be engaged in interstate commerce when you feed the grain from your own fields to your own cows. Now, why did they do this? Well, it doesn't look like a cross-border transaction to me, which was the old definition. Rather, their view was they understood that the moment you wanted to prop up the price of domestic grain in the United States to the point where it was close to three times the price in the world market, you had to find a way to make sure that people wouldn't cheat on the cartel and dump their excess production elsewhere. And if you didn't, they couldn't sell it interstate, they'd sell it in-state. And if they couldn't sell it in-state, they'd consume it on their own farms. And Wickard was no small deal. At the time that this happened, essentially 20% of the grain supply in the United States was being directed towards vertical integration and internal consumption precisely because of these price situations. So it's a standard government situation. Once you want to rig a market, you just have to rig it against all forms of circumvention, and that means the reason we sacrificed the good principles of federalism was to make the world safe for agricultural cartels. You will not get too many farmers who oppose that, but at least as a matter of first principle, one ought to understand the rather ignoble cause to which all this constitutional ingenuity was put by Justice Jackson when he wrote that opinion. Now, that's the way the things start to look on the commerce side. When you start talking about individual rights, it's a rather confused history, but basically the proposition is this. Whatever your constitutional home, private property, liberty under due process of privileges and immunities, the issue is whether or not the classical liberal framework would apply to those cases in which the disposition of labor or property was at stake. And the traditional view was the single best protection that any individual has in the marketplace is a number of sellers and a number of buyers on the opposite side of the market so that you could pay off one against the other. And that means if you don't like Duane Reade, you go to Rexall or to Walmart or somewhere else. This means, in effect, that the single strongest protection that you want in order to fight monopolies is free entry on the part of new competitors without obstacles created either by a labor statute or a zoning law or anything else of the sort. And there is no question that when the classical liberal writers on the Supreme Court said that the police power allowed you to cover health and safety and morals and general welfare, that quartet did not mean everything. And in fact, outside of the quartet, the single most powerful element was things which they called labor statutes, which meant that they really believed that the police power did not allow two kinds of justifications for public activities. One of them is you could not justify state restraints on the grounds that individuals were so incompetent that they needed the state to be their guardian. You could not treat competent men and women, whether they were bakers or farmers or anybody else, as though they were wards of the state. Almost invariably, it turns out when you protect them out of jobs. And in the most famous case involving the labor situations in Lochner against New York in 1905, that's exactly what was happening. It was the union bakers who were desperately trying to impose hour restrictions that would really slam independent bakers but would leave their union shops unaffected. This is what we call in law the classic situation in which there is a law neutral in form with a disparate impact, and is a case in which the disparate impact was well known and definitely intended by the people who propagated the law. And so when they said, in effect, that labor statutes were not appropriate, they pushed the anti-paternalist line, and they pushed the line that you could not, in fact, impose various forms of regulation which converted competitive industries into monopoly. That was essentially the evil for which the old court was guilty. This, I think, is shown very nicely in one particular case. It's the New Ice Company against Lieberman, which is a great case because it involves an apparent appeal to the classical liberal ideal of decentralized power in the service of state cartels. What was at stake in this particular case was a decision on the part of the state, I think it was of Oklahoma, to give an exclusive franchise for ice to one company at the expense of everybody else. Justice Brandeis, who essentially had a level of intellectual mischief rivaled by none on the underlying issue, said this is the kind of experiment that we wish courageous states would undertake. When you use the word courageous, there's a clear, implicit understanding that courageous states do bold and sound things instead of asinine and foolish ones. But the state monopoly that he was talking about in this particular case was, in fact, an asinine and foolish act. And our friend Justice Sutherland said, liberty means the right to enter into voluntary transactions with other individuals. The moment you create a state monopoly for this ice company, it means that no entry by anybody else is going to be allowed. This is not the kind of experimentation that we want, and so therefore we will strike it down. And the contrast between the two goes to the following proposition. If you look back to Brandeis's earlier writings before he went on the court, he essentially misunderstood the message of industrialization. He did not see in the rise of the great robber barons an ability to get meat to market in refrigerated form, which made it safer and cheaper than it was before. What he saw was a group of people who disrupted the tradition of the family butcher and thereby, in effect, created all sorts of social dislocation. And by getting that particular point wrong, he then made a second mistake that compounded the error. And that was to assume that the only protection that people have against large firms is to have a situation in which there is governments that regulate the prices at which they can sell their goods, whereas in fact the best protection you have against a large firm is a second large firm which is trying to do business against you, or a small local firm. So he never understood that size is utterly immaterial in market transactions. It's price, quantity, and choice that starts to matter. And in fact, what he did is he lent himself and his particular position to support all of those who wanted to create state monopolies. And this, in effect, then starts to show itself. All of the minimum wage and maximum hour laws have exactly that kind of effect. The collective bargaining statutes that were sanctified in 1937 have exactly that effect. If you look at the zoning statutes, which were actually approved by Sutherland, the same man who wrote the right opinion, the New State Act, essentially, zoning is a way of keeping out Walmart, which is a way of keeping out competition. It's a little bit more complicated than that. I can show you a good zoning statute. I don't think I could show you two. under the point, it is the pattern. So what this book is about is essentially why the progressives went wrong. And I'm just going to state it very briefly, and I think I'll tend to take any questions if you have it, because my time, I think, is sort of running to a close, right? And I think the first of the proposition is as a normative matter, they simply did not understand that state-regulated, state-controlled monopolies were a bad thing. They didn't know how to do their supply and demand curves. What they constantly did was to think that if you protect the losers from technological innovations, you are making social improvements. They never realized that it was a recipe for long-term stagnation. And secondly, since they had so little respect for the original arguments of Adam Smith and so forth, In the end, what happened is they had very little respect for the constitutional structures that these people were able to put into place. And so what they did is they took the full tool of constitutional tricks in order to take the provisions which were essentially designed to deal with limited government and a strong system of private rights, and kept on expanding the heads of the police power, kept on narrowing the definitions of liberty, so that the original balance was completely overturned. We live in large measure in their particular legacy. What is the difference, if any, that we have today? And here is what I would say. If you were to look back at the best and the most famous of our political philosophers and legal thinkers in the period between 1900 and 1935, you would say on balance that the progressives were more eloquent and more persuasive than their classical free market defenders. If, on the other hand, you fast forward this thing another 70 or 80 years, I think it's pretty clear to say that any trained economist, any trained lawyer who looks at the actual rationales that were given for much of the key progressive legislation of the 1930s would blanch shamefacedly at the rationales that were there and would try to concoct some more sophisticated theory to support what are essentially derelict resolutions. They can't do it. Well, what does this mean? Well, it means on the one hand there's going to be a constant judicial pressure to try to cut back on some of the stuff that the progressives have done, and in my judgment this will make a very small difference in the way in which political economy paces out. I think once these systems get into place, it's a lot harder to block them, to dismantle them, than it would have been to block them 70 years ago. But that doesn't mean that all this debate is completely idle. It now means when you start getting into congressional hearings, when you get before administrative agencies, when you start to debate in forums like this, everything is now open for business again. And you can no longer treat the musings of Louis B. Brandeis or Felix Frankfurt as being authoritative. You can hold them up to ridicule. And if you do that and you do it successfully, you will slowly be able to change the balance of opinion in the United States, which will slowly shift the mix of legislation. So from time to time, you'll get Republicans like Ronald Reagan who appreciate all this stuff and do something about it. From time to time, you'll get Republicans like George Bush who haven't got the foggiest idea of what it's about, or maybe. And even then, it will still make a difference because there will be a constant intellectual opposition. We have always said that ideals and ideas really matter and really have consequences. We have seen very dramatically what happens when bad ideas start to take control of the constitutional setting. It's now a much harder task, and one in which we're actively engaged in today, is to figure out what sound ideas can do to undo some of the mess that the progressives, with their high intentions, have left us. Thank you. Mm-hmm. My God. All right, actually, we want to start from the right wing or the left wing? I mean, I will start there and then go there and then in the middle. I've got my first three. Boy, that didn't take you long to jump up. Raring to go.
I'll identify myself, Bob Weisberg, University of Illinois, NYU. You portray the progressives as making mistakes. That is, they don't see the truth which you have, and I agree with your truth, by the way. We share those views.
You don't believe that they're falsity.
But no. It's not a question of fault. It's just a question of value. So, for example, there are some people who prefer high transaction costs. They prefer a neighborhood butcher. They can go. They can schmooze. How would you make the argument that the progressives knew what they were doing? They knew that these things would impose high costs. They just prefer them. And in a court of values, how would you defend your values again, as superior to those values, given the fact that there are non-monetary considerations involved here?
Let's just start from the beginning. I agree with you that there are some people who prefer high transactions to low transactions. Dealing with the neighborhood butcher is a way to catch up on gossip, so you're buying meat plus gossip. If, in fact, you are correct that that's the commodity or commodity set that's being purchased, Walmarts will not be able to drive them out of business. And so, therefore, the right answer as a predictive matter is to say that to the extent that certain kinds of business transactions have a norm-reinforcing aspect to them, which large impersonal agencies cannot supply, if you don't regulate the choice between the two of them, you will not see a 100-to-1 split in favor of low goods and impersonal service. You will start to see somebody who will favor high price and smiling service as an alternative set. So what's the difference between them? I am not coming here and saying to you, I have now examined the situation and the czar of the American economy. I am banning all small businesses, a few within 15 people, to sell their wares in any butcher shop in this nation. I'm not saying that. They're saying it in the opposite way. And so the objection that one has to them is not that their insights about human behavior are necessarily wrong, but what you're saying about them is they're not necessarily right either, and so therefore they don't have the slightest ground whatsoever to say, we're going to knock out the kinds of production that you like in order to ensure the kinds of production that we like. What they're doing, in effect, is they're taking a political majority on sentiment and then converting it into a universal norm. They shouldn't do that. That's the first point. The second point is there is a peculiar dance and symbiotic relationship which is less than wholesome. I truly believe that Louis Brandeis and Felix Frankfurt is absolutely as dumb as they sounded when they wrote this stuff and believed everything that they said. I don't question their bona fides for a moment. And if you read some of the quotes in the book about Brandeis and Frankfurt, I mean, they really are stunning. But there were lots of guys out there who were running labor unions who understood that community and monopoly meant the same thing. And so what you did is you had this very powerful situation which worked perfectly well. You get these high-minded guys up there who are incorruptible. You never bought them off. They're giving you the public speech, and then you get your guys going into Congress and lobbying saying, hey, this is what you got to do for the Teamsters today. And I think that that 1-2 touch turned out to be immensely more powerful. And one of the reasons why you get so unhappy about all of this is, in fact, once you know the situation, you realize that these guys were supplying the flea leaf, the cloak, the sort of intellectual covering for what was a much less situation. Then there's the third thing I want to say, which is one of the things you started to talk about was what I like to call soft externalities, which is, isn't it nice to live in a community where everybody sits on the stoop, right? Well, it is until you get air conditioning, right? And then you're not so sure anymore. Well, it turns out the problem with soft externalities in one sentence is this. They don't all cut in the same direction. There are some people who say, the last thing I want to do is to go into that dummy butcher and have him quiz me about my divorce. I just don't want to hear it. I just want to buy meat. That guy's going to say, my community value right to Walmart's. I want to be anonymous. When I want to show my face, I'll do it in my church, my temple, or my bridge club. I don't want to do it there. Well, if I were to say that's a perfectly legitimate sentiment, therefore I ban the butcher shop, you would say this is crazy. And so what you have to do is to recognize that there are so many externalities that the safe thing to do with all of these soft sentimental ones is to ignore them. Because what the progressives do and what everybody tends to do is they always play at one side. So the modern environmental says, I cannot go to sleep at the thought that there will be a ski resort on the slopes of Mount Shasta. And then I wake up and I say, I am just distressed that there won't be a ski resort. Well, why is it that their pinings and musings matter and mine are those of some sort of dolt? And the answer is they're constantly shifting from the technical economics, which says all you do when you measure externalities is the extent of the shift, to saying that some are legitimate and some are not. And it's the legitimacy that determines the day on soft externalities, and theirs are legitimate and mine are boorish. Well, I happen to think that they're boorish, I mean, you know. And so I want to ban rock and roll. I get too many things. Anyhow, that's the answer. That ended it.
Thanks, Heather Higgins. I just
wondered. Oh, just you wait. I didn't recognize you under that hat, Heather. A dangerous person.
Oh, no, no. I'm just going to set you up, and you can just knock it out of the park. If you want to talk about Kehoe and land use and use versus benefit and what the prospects are for changing that decision,
okay.
I'd love to hear your thoughts.
This is, you know, this is basically give a different talk from the one you gave and talk about the land use side of this issue. First, that's perfectly appropriate, and let me, of course, link it back to the basic
talk.
Yeah. What? Well, I'll talk about that, too. I'm in favor of it. I'm not in favor of marriage licenses, however, which is a rather different proposition, which gets you into George Bush land. But we will not talk about that yet. Let's go back, and on the land use case, you have to understand that the problem with Kelo, which is the decision which says that we can throw people out of their homes in New London, Connecticut, for a development to be named later, which will surely lose money because it's being run by a bunch of incompetents. But we put aside the cheap editor. The root of Kelo is actually a New Deal or progressive era decision known as Euclid against the Ambler Realty Company, which was the first of the great zoning cases. And what they did is they took this perfectly serviceable 68-acre plot, and they broke it up into three zones so that it could not be put to its highest and best use, that of building a factory, and instead lost about 75% of its value. And Justice Sutherland, on a bad day, lined himself up with the progressives and said, zoning, it's a form of state regulation designed to improve neighborhoods and communities, constitutional. We're not going to look at the particulars, because if you did, they all stunk in that particular case. Now, once you do that, you have the following terrible dynamic. You can have a state government decide to downzone a particular parcel of land, wipe out 75% of its value. Why are they going to do that? Generally speaking, we'll have few cases of pure malice in which you want to wipe out the value because you want to see somebody suffer. Almost invariably, if you knock down the value to somebody because his site of land is not usable for a certain purpose, you're going to increase the value of some inferior site which operates in competition to it. So you've got the land use political game in there. If, in fact, you start to run this kind of situation, in the long run, any community that has very punitive zoning will lose its tax base and will lose its success and will become a derelict. If you want a perfect illustration of that, try New London, Connecticut, as a place which was down on its luck, in part because of incompetence. If you've got powerful zoning ordinances because of this progressive tradition and economic stagnation, then if you're a progressive, you believe there's only one way in which you can do things sensibly. Get $73 million in free money from the state and then waste it on infrastructure in order to build losing projects on your own land. But you have to assemble the land. And well, in this case, actually, it was amazingly easy. 90 of the 92 acres of land that were at issue in New London were already owned by public bodies. So the takings issue did not rise. But these guys suffered from an excess of grandeur, and they insisted that they had to have all 92 acres, even though that meant knocking out 15 private homes. And if, in fact, you start with the progressive view of the world, that the zoning ordinances shall always be looked upon as wonderful because of the effort to serve the community, and so you give them a free pass, then when it comes to the other side, well, now how do you develop a stagnant community? Well, you've got these same benevolent guys out there. You've got to give them a free pass on what they take and what they don't take. And so now, if you start looking at the term, you say, well, public use means public benefit. That's what you said. Now, here's the constitutional complication. If you actually go back to American constitutional law, you cannot find or support the proposition that Justice Stevens, who wrote this decision, invented the switch from public use to public benefit. You cannot even find that the shift was done in 1954 in Berman and Parker by our good friend Justice Douglas, whose credentials as a progressive are absolutely unchecked. You have to go back to 1860 because those are the early cases in which the transformation took place. Now the issue here is, why did they take place? And once you understand that, you'll see why it is that the Constitution is a slippery and difficult document to interpret. The early cases in which they switched the term had to do with mills, which you wanted to build on a river, which meant that you had to flood private farmland. Or they had to do with mines, where there was a mine on the top of the hill and you had to get the ore to the track and therefore had to put a tram over some scrubland. And essentially what the early guys did is they said, under circumstances where there are real bona fide intractable holdout problems because of strong locational situations, you can't build a mill except by a water. You can't take ore out of a mine except where it's buried, right? We're going to allow the state to overcome that bilateral monopoly in conditions of abject necessity. That was essentially the set of rules that were developed as early as 1860 through about 1905. And it was those precedents that were then said to be, well, the government can do anything they want for public benefit. The right way to understand it is you do not want to say that when the state deals with a genuine assembly problem, that it's powerless to use the eminent domain problem to achieve coordination. But at the same point, you don't want to say anytime some private guy wants to coordinate land that he's got a real problem, we got to help him. Because there's nothing which says that you have to put the hotel in New London. In fact, there were two new hotels that were built in neighboring communities from the time that this ill-fated plan was started to the time that it actually went to its end in litigation. So the really difficult question is to be able to talk about the bilateral monopoly problem as something you have to worry about, but not let it spill over so that the government can do anything it darn well pleases. And in this particular case, there's a real reason, or many real reasons, why you want to stop the excess. One of them is favoritism. My favorite little physical illustration of this is a detail which Justice Stevens would not talk about. Because remember, if you believe in rational basis, facts could never get in your way, so why bother to address them? And that's exactly, by the way, what Justice Sutherland did in the Euclid case. He says, we know why we need zoning, because apartment houses are parasites on good residential neighborhoods. That was his words, not mine. Guess who lived in the parasitic homes? Figure that out. Because zoning was obviously an anti-racial divide. So you get all of this stuff, and it kind of comes into this sort of, we trust these guys. But you get these incredible ad hoceries. In the Kelo case, there were two buildings that stood side by side. One was called the Italian Dramatic Club, which was the watering hole for local New London politicians. It still stands. Next to it is the Brelsky House. They had an abutting party wall. Oh, they said, we cannot possibly build around this structure which prevents the integrated development of this large plot of land. This was actually mentioned in the Connecticut Supreme Court, and three guys saw it. And the attitude of the four who won said, you know, we're progressives. If the court thinks that the Dramatic Club should stay and the house should go, who are we to second-guess their judgment, right? I mean, it's exactly what they said. And Justice Stevens, well, he's more courageous. He doesn't even address the question. Because at that point, the whole arbitrariness of the situation is there. So what did we argue? I wrote a brief in this case. And I argued that, A, the bilateral monopoly condition was really stringent. And it was depressing to see Justice Stevens selectively take the words out of those opinions that helped him, but ignore all the other words in those same passages, even in the same sentences, that cut against him. But I also said, look, there's an easy way to do this case. I said, look, ask them what they're going to do with this land when they take it. And all of you said, well, this is a real assembly problem. We can't build anything. That would be great if you knew what they were going to build. So we kept on asking, what do you plan to put on the land owned by these houses now? We don't know yet. Oh, no, they didn't quite say that. They said it's for park support purposes. Will you tell us what they are? We'll say, when we get a park, we'll figure out how to support it, is essentially what they said. They wouldn't let us know, for a purpose to be named later, right? That's what they said. So I said, and I think the dissenting judges said below, is let's tell you what to do. Wait until they come forward with a purpose that they actually need the land. Then we could figure this out. And I think you're going to be wrong, because when you start to see that, it won't look very good. And one of the things that was so distressful about the opinion was that it didn't have to come out this way. You could have reversed this case and left the larger questions of planning, assembly, and urban renewal to one side by actually looking at the facts. And I don't think Justice Stevens understood that. If he had tried to do this, had given some limitations on the power of the state to act in a case which even every serious planner regards as a public disgrace for the process and for the result, you would have stopped this huge outcry. And what's the public reaction to this? Well, it's in many ways, it's overreactive. There are a lot of people saying, well, you can't use eminent domain power to take farmland for roads, right? Because we just don't like state coercion at all. That's going too far, I think. What you really want to do is to essentially recognize, as you deal with public use, the basic classical liberal presumption that all uses of government power take place under a presumption of error. And that means, in effect, at the very least, you have to have a very clear and very powerful case for why it is you have to take this land once you get out of the traditional classes of public uses. And that was essentially the American law from 1860 to 1930s, when they started dealing with public housing. I mean, it's not as though it's unstable. It sounds unstable, but it's actually pretty good. The reason it failed is because Justice Stevens, who is the worst, I hope this is on tape, the worst judge on all land use issues, starts with the progressive assumption that you have to give government free rein, because the moment you subject them to any kind of constitutional mistake, they may act too hastily, or they may make an error, or they may have to pay for a mistake. He only sees one kind of error, which is indecisive public officials. He doesn't see the other kind of error. Utterly corrupt public officials doing really monstrous things. And once you realize that the two are there, you want to put much tougher restraints. And if you tightened up on the zoning restrictions, you would reduce the need to have these desperate last measures. That would reduce the pressure on the public use. So it all kind of fits together as part of a regrettable but integrated whole. All right, one last, yes, sir? And then?
Michael Myers, New York Civil Rights Coalition.
Okay.
Back to the title of your book and the topic of your talk.
Sure.
How progressives rewrote the Constitution. I think, and I haven't read your book yet, but I will. It would be a much more interesting book if you said, if it were, why progressives rewrote the Constitution.
Well, I did that too.
Oh, good.
And that was the whole talk about political theory.
Okay. Because we know how the Supreme Court, for example, looked at, reinterpreted the Equal Protection Clause to reverse separate but equal. They looked for modern evidence to reverse their own doctrine. We know that the Commerce Clause was used even before then as a way to making of Congress's power to make sure that blacks didn't have to change seats while they were on the Greyhound bus passing from state to state. We also know that the court looked at privacy issues and autonomy issues with respect to reproductive freedom issues. Sure. And congressional power as well as Supreme Court power to regulate discrimination, to do away with it. So I guess my my question to you is, since we have what they call a living document in terms of the Constitution, what is so wrong with progressives rewriting and reinventing and reinterpreting bad doctrine, bad ideas, bad values based on their own view of what the Constitution requires in modern society?
First of all, I don't know where you got the living Constitution idea from. You smuggled that in very nicely. Let me see if I could smuggle it out again, or at least introduce it in a way which makes it seem perfectly banal and therefore correct, all right? Here we do. Let me give you a version of a living constitution that I uphold, all right? Congress shall not have the power to regulate commerce amongst the several states. And now it turns out in 1787, how did you get from one state to another? By ship or by horse. Now what we do is we introduce the telephone. And the doctrine is Congress does not have the power to regulate telephone conversations between the two states because these things were not in existence as of 1787. What kind of living constitution do you need in order to have telephone communication, rail communication, air communication between states regulated? You just simply have to look at the document and say these guys were smart enough to talk about the activity which was subject to federal regulation, but they make no mention of the means. Therefore, we understand that they had a living constitution in that they did not wish to restrict the power of the federal government to regulate interstate transactions to those things which involved only the modalities in existence in 1787. But then, of course, if you're going to start living with this constitution, you've got to live with both halves of it. These guys also believed in a profound consideration that local matters were better subject to local government. The Europeans even called this the principle of subsidiarity. We don't have to call it that. And so what happens is our Constitution lives. What we have to do is to make sure that the balance between the federal and the state stuff doesn't get whacked up because we give federal powers over new modalities, which means that local telephone calls, local railroads, right, local airplane flights are outside the scope of federal commerce, just the way the local coach ride was outside of that. So we have the Constitution live in both directions and preserve the original document. And about 10 years ago in the Green Bag Journal, I'm happy to say it was started by five of my University of Chicago students, all of whom I think took my land use class at one point or another and got a choice morsel on this. What happens is that what you do in effect is you have fidelity to the Constitution without transformation. So what's the illicit form of living Constitution? Is we essentially have a document which gives its preference to state competition and to competition between goods as opposed to state monopolies. And we think that that applies to widgets that were made in 1787 and to computer chips that are made in the year 2006. So it transforms itself up or down. Now, what about the race question, right? Now, this is it. And this is a very different problem. The first thing to understand is that the only decent respect that all the cause of racial equality had in the progressive period came from a view which was libertarian rather than statist. You remember which great progressive president segregated the civil service in 1913? Do you remember? Well, I was. It was Woodrow Wilson. Wilson, right? And when you start looking at this, this is what you have. The conception of liberty is really very narrow, and the conception of a police force is incredibly broad, so that the potential that there might be a disruption when black and white workers would fight in the lunchroom is strong enough to require complete segregation of the civil service. Those were not made-up rationales that I'm doing after the fact. Those were the ones who were put there at the time. So if you basically take the really hard line on this stuff, that, you know, if you want to start talking about force and fraud as reasons to justify it, it can't be a pie-in-the-sky argument. And in addition, if you've got an integrated civil service for 50 years and you find maybe one racial altercation that takes place in that time, your band is going to be really guilty on the grounds of overbreath. So on the public side, You just don't let this stuff get started because you keep with a much more limited government conception. What about the private side? Well, as I mentioned about Euclid, and the words are right in the opinion, go back and read it, he starts basically saying we want strong zoning because we have to be able to zone on racial grounds. He doesn't use those words, but when you start talking about parasites who live in apartment houses, you figure out what it is that this man is thinking of back in 1926. But 10 years before, there was the case of Buchanan and Worley. Are you familiar with that one? This is a case in which it turned out that the great city of Louisville, where Louis Brandeis was born, decided that it was going to have a checkerboard ordinance in which some blocks would be reserved black and some blocks would be reserved white. And the question was whether or not this was consistent with the rights to own and dispose of property in your free will. And it turned out Buchanan and Worley were on the same side of this case. It was a fictitious conveyance in which the buyer said, I can't go through with this because of the restrictions that are imposed. And so they litigated, and the Supreme Court says, sorry, racial classifications like that simply do not work. So that's a case in which the libertarian side on property was used in its defense. Now, let me be perfectly clear about my own modern position. On both Commerce Clause grounds and equal rights grounds, I think the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is dead unconstitutional. I've said it multiple times. So, dead unconstitutional. I don't think the federal government has the power to regulate on the local uses of this in ordinary firms. And I think on individual choice grounds, it's a desperate mistake. Now, why is it that I think this? Well, one of the reasons might surprise you a little bit, but if you think about it, I think it will make more sense. It is the only way to make affirmative action by private firms non-problematic. And I think it's actually the single most important way. And it does so in two ways. The first thing that happens in any workplace is the only way you're going to get your workforce to work cooperatively is if they share a common vision. You make every firm look exactly the same under the Civil Rights Act. You're not going to find a place in which I can form Bigots Anonymous sitting out there in which every person who refuses to work with blacks or whites or whatever it is, they go in up there. Once they're gone, my firm is easier to run. Simply because I don't have to deal with the heterogeneity of taste on a variable that I really manage. And this sorting function systematically overlooked. You read the debates on the 64 Act about how labor markets work. It's the same level of ignorance that you had 30 years before. Now, I loved Hubert Humphrey. Great guy. 1948 convention in Philadelphia. You remember it, right? I was old enough to remember that.
I know about it. I don't remember.
Well, I do.
I wasn't there.
I was alive. I was five. But, I mean, you kind of knew. That the guy was, you know, a gutty fellow standing up against Strom Thurmond. It was, but, you know, this is essentially you want to manage. The second thing is the moment you say that choice is there, you don't have to give funny public justifications for affirmative action, half of which turn out to be false. You could simply say, this is my business. We think it runs better that way. Everybody else butt out and let us do it. And I think, in effect, you will get more improvement on racial temperament with that attitude rather than having a single monopolist called the federal government running the EEOC telling every firm in the United States exactly how it ought to run its racial business and make a complete mess out of it. You never, ever want to have that level of concentration in the hands of a single body. So that what I really think is, and I'm not the only one to say this, in 1965, Harold Demsitz, Chicago economist, wrote something in the North Carolina Law Review in which he said open markets are much better correctives of race and prejudice than any form of government mandates because what the mandates start to do is they put the hotheads in control. And you never, ever want to let that happen. And when I say hotheads, I don't necessarily mean the rabid racial integrationists or the rabid segregationists. You could alternate between the two of them. But you never, ever want to have that level of concentration of power when you can have decentralized solutions. So I think all things considered, yeah, I want this Constitution to live and breathe and to be perfectly sensible. But a living Constitution, to my mind, is one that takes the sound political philosophy of 225 years ago and updates it to a world of neutrinos and patents, rather than somebody says, gee, it turns out that now people have belts that they made of tungsten alloys they didn't have 200 years ago, so what we have to do is to move to a corporatist model. And I don't think that there's any justification for that shift. That's not living constitution. That's just a form of intellectual suicide, in my judgment. So I fight it.
Thank you.